From WUOT News, this is The Method, a series exploring the intersection of science and society. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. In just a moment, East Tennesseans take to the streets for science. But first, human lifespans are short. Too short, in fact, to see with our own eyes biological, geological, and climatological changes that take place over centuries or even millennia. But information about those changes is encoded in every tree. The University of Tennessee's Dr. Henry Grissino Mayer specializes in reading the history contained within tree rings, and he spoke with WUOT's Megan Jamerson.
I was excited to see that the University of Tennessee has the second largest library in dendrochronology. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's one of the most comprehensive libraries of its type in the world, and I'm very proud of that.
Describe for our listeners what are tree rings, and what is dendrochronology
more? This always catches people by surprise that there are scientists that study tree rings. And now scientists that study tree rings for a living, we're called dendrochronologists. And that means learning about past time from the tree ring record.
So what are you, I guess, looking for in a tree that reveals this information?
Many things. Trees are nature's ultimate recorders of the environment. They just stay in one place year after year after year. In fact, some pine trees in California have been in one place for 4,000 years even. We finally found one that's 5,000 years old, the oldest living thing on this planet. They record what's happening to them in their tree rings. I think we all know that a big fat wide tree ring means it was a good year for tree growth, lots of rainfall perhaps, favorable temperatures, but a really narrow tree ring means drought, bad conditions. So we use that information and we can develop or come up with, say, 1,000 years worth of tree rings back to the year 1000, and then we can say how much rainfall or what the temperatures were like at any given year.
Did you do something similar to that for the Eastern Tennessee region? Because I know you had some predictions about fires and droughts.
People often don't know that trees can actually be scarred by fire. The trees have actually become adapted to repeated fires, even here in the eastern United States. These fires were normally low intensity. They would scar the trees but not kill it. So, for example, one tree might have evidence of about 15 to 20 individual fires that tree recorded. And then we can reconstruct the history of fire for any given area, such as the Great Smoky Mountains National Park.
Are you seeing a charred kind of coloring or something like that?
It is actually charred on the outside of the tree. We extract a cross-section from it that we will sand it down and be able to see numerous black scars from numerous fires over the past 100, 200, or even 300 years.
You've mentioned, you know, several uses, climate research, fire tracking throughout history. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that,
anything that affects the tree can be recorded. We have dendrochronologists that specialize in extracting earthquake signals from trees. But even volcanic eruptions leave their signal in the tree ring record. And so, for example, I'm analyzing trees in the Northern Rockies in Montana, and I find a signal from a major eruption in Peru in the year 1600 from a volcano called Huayna Petina. Tree rings can record what humans do. For example, air pollution, acid rainfall, groundwater pollution, contamination of the environment, you know, chemical spills, you know, whatever happens to the tree is going to record it. And so it's just a matter of us using statistical techniques to tease out these signals.
I think I did see, though, there's some archaeological uses as well.
I do a lot of historical archaeology research.
And you dated, was it Abraham Lincoln's log cabin?
I've dated Abraham Lincoln's birthplace log cabin. Anything made of wood has the potential to be dated by tree rings. In other words, when were the trees cut down to make this cabin?
UT Professor Henry Grissino Mayer speaking with WUOT's Megan Jamerson. Last Saturday, about 300 people marched around downtown Knoxville, not in protest against something, but in support of something, science. It was one of several marches for science that took place across the nation. Caroline Rowcliffe attended and documented Knoxville's march.
I think a lot of people are upset with the current administration ignoring and oppressing science. They have recently placed a suppression order on science based on organizations, for example, the EPA, the National Park Service, and even the USDA. And I think folks came together because they're upset over that. They want the current administration to hear them and share the message that science serves the common people and the public interest. We need it, and we need accurate science education in public schools. We also need more funding for scientific research. It is definitely underfunded, and I think that's a huge issue.
What was the, if you could characterize the general attitude of the folks who were there? Was it jovial? Were people angry? What was the mood like?
I think it was kind of in between. A lot of people were kind of upset, but I think these protests are put together to empower people and to kind of excite them to continue to move forward.
Who do you think the target audience was? And the reason I ask that is, of course, there was a larger version of the March for Science up in Washington, and there's something, of course, about that symbolism in that location. That's the seat of the nation's government. They were protesting right in front of the Capitol building, visible, you know, symbols of the government and of the legislative branch in particular. But what about a march in Knoxville? Who do you think the target audience was? Was it local politicians, citizens? Who do you think you were trying to reach?
I think we were reaching our local politicians that work with the current administrative team in Washington.
Did you get any reaction from just, you know, regular folks, maybe somebody who saw it on the news or somebody who came by the University of Tennessee and wondered what was up? Did you have people who were not involved with the protest come by and listen to what you had to say?
Yes. As we were marching, we had lots of vehicles honk at us to show that they supported us, lots of hands out the window kind of cheering us on. Mm. One girl that, like, my little group met up with, she just decided to come that morning. She didn't really know about it until that exact morning, and she just showed up literally with a pizza box that had her sign on it. We had so many people that just kind of joined us, like, didn't really, I think, know exactly what was going on, and they asked questions, and we informed them, and then they kind of banded with us, so it was a great day.
Caroline Rowcliffe is a photographer and videographer. She's a student at Pellissippi State Community College, and we've been talking about the March for Science. You can see the video that Caroline put together showing scenes from the March for Science at our website, WUOT.org. And Caroline, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
That does it for The Method. Thanks so much for joining us. You can listen to this episode again online at WUOT.org. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth.